You're listening to the second half of episode 546 of Unwelcome Guests, how the environmental movement died of success and what to do about it. This is John Stauber talking to the 20th National Conference on the Coalition Against the Misuse of Pesticides from 2002.
I'm sure you've all heard this. He said, an axe is just a little bureaucratic mark on a piece of paper, and a spur is just a big drip. And by then, the Forest Service sort of, you know, crawled out of the room and swore they would never do another public hearing on this. But what I found out, thanks to Billy, we brought her to Wisconsin for testimony before the legislature in 1975 in a desperate attempt to try to get state legislation banning the Agent Orange herbicides, desperate because, you know, the Wisconsin legislature is totally in hock to agribusiness interests. By then, Billy's hair was gone from cancer treatments. She was wearing a platinum blonde wig. She loved to dress in a lot of turquoise and silver. And she really looked sort of like a caricature of Annie Oakley. And she just talked the truth. And it was really inspirational meeting her. But like I say, a year later, she was actually dead of cancer, no longer with us, and now really forgotten. But for 3 years, we shut down the spraying, and then they tried to start it up again in 77. And by then, the real focus of the movement, of course, was the incredible work being done out here in the Pacific Northwest. The little bit of herbicide spraying that they were doing in Wisconsin paled in comparison to the massive spraying in the Pacific Northwest. And people like Paul Merrill and Carol Van Strum and Carol's husband, Steve Van Strum, and the Hodads were organizing and doing tremendous work. I remember in 78, Carter was president then, there was supposedly a change at the Forest Service, and a new guy was in who was going to be more cooperative. So, you know, we organized a big demonstration when he came and spoke in northern Wisconsin. And being a good liberal Democrat, which means an environmentalist, he was really freaked, you know, by this demonstration. He said, "What do you people want?" I said, "We want a federal meeting on this. You know, we want Washington, D.C. conference on this. You got it." Amazingly, they actually set it up in early 1978. And it was completely stacked, no surprise here, of course, towards Dow and the spray companies and the use of herbicides. But Steve Van Strum came and other people came, and we organized our own conference. And it was really empowering for people all over the country to get together. And by then, the wheels were in motion. Folks out here had were organizing the ALSEA study, the monitoring that linked miscarriages with herbicide spraying. It was in 1978 that I met my first PR flack. It was at this Forest Service conference, and afterwards the Forest Service threw this little party, and the industry people were there, and us scruffy activists were there. And this guy sauntered up to me in a suit, and he goes, "I know who you are. You're from Wisconsin. I saw you last year when that woman was, or in 75 when that woman was testifying." And I was taken aback. I said, "Who are you?" He goes, "I work for Dow." And I said, "Well, what do you do for Dow?" He said, "I keep track of people like you." And I said, "Well, gee, are there many people like you?" And he said, "There's enough of us." And then he started sticking his finger in my chest, and he said, "You'll never win, you know. We just tell the Forest Service to jump, and they ask us how high." And then he spun around and left. The next year, there was really a huge victory. All our victories are always partial, but it was a tremendous and historical victory. Eric Jansen of Friends of the Earth had a lot to do with it. Carol Van Strum and the folks organizing in Oregon, and Barbara Bloom, you know, announced restrictions, at least on 2,4-5-T. So when I come here tonight and see this audience, you know, I think back 24, 30 years to my involvement in this issue and my activism, and I realize, and Sheldon and I really make this clear at the end of our book, Trust Us, We're Experts, that, you know, tonight I'm among the experts. The real experts are people like you, people who personally get involved in battling issues, who educate yourselves to the issues, and who are out to make a difference. And, you know, Billy Shewcraft was that type of expert. And, of course, the environmental movement actually began with Rachel Carson, who was already one of the United States' most renowned science writers when, in 1962, she blew the whistle on pesticides. And back then, you know, the pesticide production industry was relatively tiny, $300 million a year. And this stuff was, of course, all wonderful, and then out comes Silent Spring. And that book was viciously attacked. We write in Toxic Sludge is Good for You about a PR flack by the name of E. Bruce Harrison, who actually, as a 30-year-old PR flack for the chemical industry, had a major role in coordinating the vicious attack on Rachel Carson and her book. Monsanto, Dow, all the big pesticide companies were involved. They smeared Rachel Carson as a woman. How can a woman even write a book like this? You know, one of America's premier science writers at the time. Velsicol tried to, through the courts, prevent the book from ever coming out. But, of course, that book struck a chord like no other book has since. And it ignited a movement that resulted in millions of people in the streets, April 22nd, 1970, in the first Earth Day, just a spontaneous affirmation of everything that Rachel Carson warned about, cared about, lived for. And the bad news, of course, is that Rachel Carson was dying of breast cancer herself at the time she was writing that book and was dead a short time afterward. E. Bruce Harrison, unfortunately, is alive and well today and very much with us and seen in Washington, D.C., in the propaganda industry as the father of what they call environmental PR. Well, it's really anti-environmental PR. His clients are, you know, the automobile industry, the petrochemical industry, the mining industry, and they began the anti-environmental movement that has been winning, 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 at least in Washington, over the last 30 years, began also with this response and backlash to Rachel Carson. And they learned something very important by the first Earth Day, which is that if Dow wades in and viciously attacks people like us, it's a loser because the environment, environmental health, our children, our future are extremely important. Isn't that shocking? Something besides money is actually important to people. And what the industry learned and learned from people like E. Bruce Harrison is greenwashing. And by the 70s, the environmental movement was moving to Washington, becoming professionalized, becoming entrenched in big organizations like Natural Resources Defense Council, Environmental Defense Fund, Audubon. The corporate anti-environmental movement was learning from the environmental movement and moving in the other direction, creating their own anti-environmental campaigns at the grassroots and at the national level, pumping money into advertising, public relations, and partnerships with big environmental groups, pouring money into, you know, the Wilderness Society, the National Wildlife Federation, most of the big environmental groups, frankly, to buy an image of respect. And in our book, Toxic Sludge is Good for You, we write about the death of the environmental movement. As I was researching that book in 1995, I came across this wonderful book by E. Bruce Harrison titled Going Green. And in it, the fellow called the father of environmental PR, who I call the godfather of greenwashing, was really bragging about the death of the environmental movement. He said basically this: the environmental movement died. It died right around the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. And what it died of was success. What Harrison says is that by the 90s, the movement had been transformed into a bunch of big nonprofit corporations with multi-million dollar budgets, incredibly well-paid six-figure executive directors. The need to appear like they were succeeding in greening, but no longer really having a radical agenda, now primarily being concerned with raising money and meeting their multi-million dollar annual budget. An analysis surprisingly similar to that of maybe our foremost investigative reporter, Mark Dowie, who in his extremely important book that came out in 95-96, Losing Ground, American Environmentalism at the Close of the Century, really attacks the so-called third-wave environmentalism. It was very, very instructional and important to be able to read Harrison bragging about this. And what was really ironic, too, is that as sort of an aside in his book, E. Bruce Harrison says, you know, we know how to defeat the big environmental organizations. It's through co-optation, no problem. He really described a technique pioneered by a firm called Mongovan, Bisco, and Duchin. In fact, I would be surprised if a representative of this firm isn't at your conference. If they're not here, either you're not doing your job or they're not doing their job. I suppose both are possible, but since I know you're doing your job, and unfortunately I know they're doing their job, I suspect they're here. This is a fascinating firm. It has about 30 employees. It's based in Washington, D.C., and it provides intelligence information to Fortune 500 companies. And the natural resource it mines are you. It investigates, studies activists of all sorts, anyone who is raising any issue that's a threat to any corporation. And it maintains dossiers on leadership. It maintains dossiers on organizations. And then it advises its clients like, you know, Monsanto, Philip Morris, on how to defeat activists. And here's what Mongovan, Bisco, Duchin says. You defeat activists by dividing them into categories. This was a talk Ron Duchin gave it to one of his clients, National Cattlemen. And those categories are this. You've got your radicals. Now, the radicals are really a dangerous lot. In fact, I think most of you would fall, I'm sure, into this category. The radicals aren't necessarily politically radical. You can be a Republican, a Bible Belt Christian conservative Republican, and still be a radical if you're a pain in the butt to, say, a toxic incinerator that's slated for your community. Because as a radical, you understand the problem. You're not going to be persuaded or bought off. You're not going to be fooled by sophisticated PR, and you're not going to compromise. You don't want it. You don't want it in your backyard. Get it out of here. That makes you a radical in the traditional sense of going to the root of the problem. The radicals are always the biggest problem. Luckily, we have the realists. Now, who are the realists? Well, the realists, it turns out, are actually the sorts of big green environmental organizations that E. Bruce Harrison brags about, you know, organizations that accept money from industry to partner with industry and come to win-win solutions that inevitably down the road are solutions that sell out the community, sell out the environment, sell out the radicals, but look really good at the time. Mark Dowie talks about this sort of win-win solution in terms of the Environmental Defense Fund, for instance, and its partnership with McDonald's. And I think I'll read an excerpt from that a little later. The realists are extremely important in this divide-and-conquer strategy, but there's also a third group out there that has to be neutralized and won over, and that's the idealists. And let's hope, no matter how cynical we might become, that all of us are idealists. It's very important. And we're all idealists when we hear about a problem. We become outraged. We want to do something. And it's usually the pesky radicals who are raising heck, occupying some corporation's lobby, insisting that the media cover this issue, and getting the issue in front of the idealists. The very group that E. Bruce Harrison says is the most dangerous and difficult group, the radical activists. So here's how that scam is run. Basically, the industry PR people come up with something that they can take to the realists. Often these realists are on good terms with them already because they're pumping money into their environmental organizations, and folks with really nice titles like the Executive Vice President for Corporate Social Responsibility are well in touch with the big environmental organizations, and they'll sit down and they'll go, look, you know, no one cares more about this issue than us. I mean, after all, we're people too. We live in this community. Our kids grow up here. They breathe this air. They drink this water. Do you think we don't care, for God's sake? Well, we do, you know. Stop, stop. You're killing me, man. Literally. And And so here we have a proposition, and, you know, this is our solution, and it'll make us all look good. And, you know, if we do what these radicals want, it's going to destroy the economy. We're going to have to move out of town. Everything's going to suffer. So what happens is, as Ron Duchin describes it, a compromise is reached, something that can be packaged as win-win. Maybe, you know, one of these community advisory panels is set up. Some sort of voluntary agreement is reached. Some sort of standards are set. But interestingly, when you look at it, there's no monitoring and there's no enforcement. But boom, there you go, out the window, the deal is done. That's how you defeat the environmental movement. And that's what Ebruce Harrison has learned, and that's what Mongovan, Bisco, and Duchin has learned. By the way, when Ron Duchin was last seen, he was giving an award to John Adams of the Natural Resources Defense Council in Washington, D.C. at this spiffy event at the press club. And there's this organization probably none of you have ever heard of, but it's called, I believe, the Natural Resource Council of America. Nice sounding name, $1 million a year budget. And this is where the rubber hits the road in Washington, D.C. The corporations pour money into this, and they pour money through this into the big green groups. And, of course, if you look at the budgets of the big green groups, it's absolutely massive. And once a year, this group holds a big awards dinner, and Ron Duchin, the man I just described, the spy master, the person who has perfected this divide-and-conquer tactic used against us, has for the last 2 years been on the awards committee, deciding which of the Washington environmental organizations is going to get this award. That is how bad it has become. And I think if you called John Adams and you said, I just heard this idiot slander you at this conference, this can't be true, he would probably say to you, who's Ron Duchin? Which in some ways really says something even worse. But anyway, you might think I'm beating up on big green groups, and indeed I am. you know, and let me tell you why, since I'm dipping into my activist past here. A lot of it has to do with going to Washington in 1978 and meeting with someone whose name I will not mention in the office of the Environmental Defense Fund. And this person had been involved in negotiations with EPA and Dow to solve this problem of the Agent Orange spraying. Well, you know, these negotiations are behind closed doors. Nothing was coming out of it. But I was, you know, wet behind the ears. I didn't know what was going on. And I mentioned that Billy Shewcraft had tipped me off to this issue. And this woman with Environmental Defense Fund just started ranting and railing about how those idiots at the grassroots, those know-nothings at the grassroots, were the real problem on this issue because they're getting people hysterical and whipped up over nothing. And if you would just let the Environmental Defense Fund and EPA and Dow deal with this as a matter of science and negotiation, the issue could be solved. So, you know, that and working with somebody good in Washington, Eric Jansen, really clued me in to what had happened in Washington. But you know, a lot of what we hear in our movement is we have no money. You know, environmentalism is very popular. All the polls show it. In fact, a Republican pollster admitted to me some years ago that two of the most important issues to everyone across the board, Republican, Democrat, Independent, it doesn't matter, are food and water. Those are the two winnable issues. And I said to him, what do you mean? He goes, it's easy. We're talking pesticides, we're talking food safety, we're talking clean air. And this was at a conference I'd bought my way into so I could get material for our first book. And as if on cue, this Republican activist who just moments before had been, I'm not kidding, I grew up in a Republican family. I know Republicans. This woman was a Republican. This Republican activist was actually explaining to her friend that she thought one real solution to poverty would be sterilizing poor women. And she was sort of half listening to what we were saying, and this was in Illinois, and she whipped around and she said, that's right, like Aldecarb, where I live here in Illinois, our wells are contaminated with Aldecarb. I want it out of my well. And she was just going off, which was great. And this Republican pollster said, see what I mean. So, You know, David Dellinger wrote a book back in the Vietnam anti-war days with a wonderful title, More Power Than We Know, and we do have more power than we know. And so then we often say, well, you know, we've got the people, we've got the commitment, we've got the know-how, we've got the multi-generations. Why don't we have a powerful environmental movement in this country? We don't have the money. Well, that's not true either. Every single year, individuals and nonprofit foundations in the United States pony up and contribute hundreds of millions of dollars to environmental organizations. And almost all of it goes to a dozen big organizations in Washington, D.C., the very organizations that Ron Duchin is giving awards to and that E. Bruce Harrison is bragging about having co-opted, organizations that are accepting corporate money. So it isn't even a case that we don't have the money. The money is there. And I'll get to this a little later in when I'm talking more about solutions. You know, it's not easy fitting a three-hour speech into an hour and 15 minutes or whatever. So let me just pick up Mark Dowie's book, because I was looking at it earlier. And he does such a wonderful job also, don't take my word for it, of explaining exactly how this divide-and-conquer strategy works. I don't usually read from books, but I'll read from Mark's. This is really important. The tendency of some national organizations to embrace issues as if they were their own and even take undeserved credit for grassroots triumphs further exacerbates grassroots enmity. Again, the most revealing example of this tendency involved the Environmental Defense Fund, which in 1992 agreed to enter negotiations with McDonald's over the use of styrofoam carry-out containers. The initiative was taken by McDonald's after a nationwide consumer campaign against McDonald's, led by Penny Newman of Concerned Neighbors in Action in Los Angeles and Lois Gibbs at the Citizens Clearinghouse for Hazardous Waste. The company planned to place small incinerators behind every outlet to burn their containers so they wouldn't fill up landfills. The campaign made the clamshell-shaped containers a symbol of wasteful throwaway packaging in the fast food industry. As Newman and Gibbs persuaded children across the country to send their used clamshells to McDonald's headquarters, every day for months on end, McDonald's corporate mailroom in Oak Brook, Illinois, was inundated with thousands of smelly packages postmarked from every state in the union. In desperation, McDonald's president, Edward Renzi, called EDF's executive director, Fred Krupp. Fred Krupp, when I wrote Toxic Sludge is Good for You back in 1995, was making over $250,000 a year then as head of EDF. At Krupp's suggestion, a joint task force was formed. Neither Gibbs nor Newman were invited to join. The task force studied McDonald's waste stream and reached an agreement whereby McDonald's gradually would switch over to coated paper containers. They're only a slight ecological improvement over styrofoam. Some believe them to be worse because the bleached paper contains little or no recycled content. The agreement fell far short of the expectations of Gibbs, Newman, and other grassroots activists. In The Nation, journalist Kirkpatrick Sale generously declared it an ambivalent success, quote-unquote. EDF and McDonald's each sent out press releases declaring victory and taking credit for environmental protection. Quote, it proves that McDonald's recognizes that the future is green, unquote, said Fred Krupp. For McDonald's general counsel Shelby Yarrow, it was a sweet deal. He found Krupp and EDF eminently reasonable. Quote, I knew they wouldn't try to talk us into doing something if it was economically unreasonable, Yarrow told the Wall Street Journal after the deal was closed. Yarrow and Renzi circumvented CCHW, Lois Gibbs Group, and went directly to EDF because they knew, quote, Fred wouldn't come in here and ask us to do Wedgwood China. I don't know what that means myself, but EDF not only accepted a surrender, but took credit for the McDonald's decision in future promotions, interviews, and newsletters, and fundraising. It never mentioned the indispensable role played by Penny Newman, Lois Gibbs, and aggressive consumer activism. The unfortunate long-term consequences of such capitulations is not only that they undermine the tireless work of grassroots activists, but also that they allow companies like McDonald's to look a lot greener than they are. The corporate exploitation of such win-win compromises has been relentless. Companies compete through paid and free media to outgreen one another. That, of course, is life on the corporate food chain. It's predictable and understandable. But the environmentalist complicity and their own PR-driven tendency to turn compromise into false triumph illuminates the desperation and impending moral crisis of the mainstream organizations. And that's Mark Dowie in a book you have to read, Losing Ground. So after Lois Gibbs read Toxic Sludge is Good for You and read about Mongovan Biscoduchin, which apparently was also working for McDonald's, I ran into her, and she just shook her head. She said, you know, I have to tell you this. She said, I've always wondered for years, how did McDonald's know to proclaim their deal with EDF on the day I was giving cesarean birth? She said, I thought I was so paranoid, thinking they must have been spying on me and knowing. But she goes, but now I realize that date was set weeks in advance. Everyone I worked with knew I was going to be in delivery that day. And she said, and I'll never forget coming out of recovery and thinking, oh, man, I am still out of it. There's Fred Krupp and McDonald's on the TV screen. I kid you not. And, you know, that's what Mongovan, Biscoduchin do. So, where does that leave me? I'll tell you where it leaves me. It leaves me with Carol Van Strum, because if you really want to know what happened to the environmental movement, how could a movement that's still one of the most popular movements in the country, how could a movement that is able to convince individuals and foundations to provide hundreds of millions of dollars a year to make environmental change, gotten so far off the track and be so incredibly weak at the federal level? Read A Bitter Fog, because it's the story of what we can accomplish and what we can do. And the last chapter is just so wonderful. And what's really bizarre is that we begin the last chapter of our book, Trust Us, We're Experts. You're just going to have to take my word for it. You want to buy it. We begin the last, and I didn't realize this, the last chapter of Trust Us, We're Experts with the same Jeffersonian quote that Carol Van Strum ends her book on, talking about, quoting Jefferson, saying, I know no safe depository, the ultimate powers of society, but the people themselves. And if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise their control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take it from them, but to inform their discretion. And so what I'm here to do tonight is to really make a modest proposal, because over the past year, I have come to absolutely believe that the only way we're going to pull the environmental movement out of this morass, the only way we're going to take the environmental movement back from $250,000-a-year sellouts like Fred Krupp and return it to people in the grassroots, the only way we're going to build a democratic, powerful, political environmental movement that can confront corporate power and take power away from corporations and not just lobby these politicians who are solidly in the pocket of corporations, but replace them, is through the anti-pesticide movement. I really, truly believe that the anti-pesticide movement, all of you in this room, hold the key. And as David Dellinger said, I think we have much more power than we know. And this is what I think. You know, I live in this nice little neighborhood in Madison, Wisconsin, and it's springtime there, too. And here's what happens every spring in my neighborhood. I walk into the hardware store and just about asphyxiate from all the chemicals there. Has anyone ever looked at death or disease rates among people who work in Ace Hardwares? Must just be phenomenal. I can't even go near them. You know, I walk down the street, and the whole yard seemed to just stink with the smell of toxic herbicides and fungicides and pesticides. But then I noticed something. It's that like at least half of us in our neighborhood don't use this stuff. Some people have incredible organic lawns and gardens and they grow food. I just let the weeds grow. I really love Creeping Charlie. Have you ever noticed? You know, it's got a nice smell. It never gets any taller than this. In the worst drought, it stays green. It's wonderful stuff. You can listen, if you can get used to patchouli, you can get used to Creeping Charlie. And I love patchouli. And so, but I look across the street and I see my very good voting neighbor who's in the teachers union hiring True Green. This big truck shows up. I think it's like the San Diego Zoo or, you know, the Orlando Aquarium. There's a big whale on the side or there's kids rolling in grass. And there's some poor guy out there with no protection spraying God knows what. And it's drifting into my yard. And, you know, that's Kathy across the street doing that. And I looked at this side and there's Catherine still trying to figure out why all her broadleaf trees are dead or dying. Well, she just dumps bags and bags of weed and feed on her lawn and curses us out for all the weeds in her lawn. And I look, you know, this side, and there's my neighbor Dan, bless his soul, who must, you know, must just pay thousands of dollars to True Green every year. And, you know, Dan's a wonderful guy, but he's got a slight insect phobia. And so every time he sees something moving in his yard, it's like an emergency call, and they're there spraying the shrubs. And it's like, oh, my God, you know. But I realized, look, we got to start thinking of this as the war, because obviously to the other side, if there's one thing I learned, this is a war. You know, Ron Duchin, his now-deceased buddy, Jack Mongovan, all these people, E. Bruce Harrison, you know, when they're riding the metro from Virginia to their K Street offices, they're reading stuff like The Art of War, and we're the enemy. One thing about war is, you know, I think we can win a war if it's hand-to-hand combat, door-to-door in our neighborhoods. Because in our neighborhood, half the people are already pesticide-free. Half the people, half the lawns, half the territory in our little neighborhood, and no one has organized this, it's because of a level of environmental consciousness. And let's look at the other half. If we were to go door to door in our neighborhood, I could sign up everyone who doesn't use this stuff. And then I could have my little neighborhood association map, and I could color in green all the land that we already control. We already control half the neighborhood, right? It's our turf, man. You're not coming in. If I look at the rest of the neighbors, I know what I'm going to hear from Kathy and Dan and most of the neighbors. This stuff is safe. You know, this stuff is harmless. How do you know it's harmless? Well, the EPA says it's harmless. I go, well, no, that's not exactly true. Actually, you see, the EPA says this stuff is dangerous, which is why they license it. It's not harmless. I absolutely know that if we were to organize an organic neighborhood association in our neighborhood, if we were to have educational materials, if we were to politely approach the reasonable people in the neighborhood, by the end of a summer, we would probably have 75 or 80% of our neighborhood organic. Also, we got a lot of really intelligent people in this neighborhood, a lot of PhDs. It's Madison, Wisconsin. And a lot of people are incredible gardeners, and they're organic gardeners, and they do great stuff, and they would love to share that information with their friends. So let me just lay this out for you, because the other day, 2 days ago, actually, a friend of mine said, what are you going to talk about? And I said, I'm going to try to lay out this vision and inspire these folks. What are you going to say? I said, I don't know. She said, well, you better think of something. I said, okay. I said, this is what I typed out. I've been reading some Kerouac, so forgive me. I said, okay. Really, it's pretty straightforward. We start with the issue of neighborhood poisoning caused by lawn and garden chemicals. Most people in most neighborhoods either don't use them or if they understood their dangers would stop. On a neighborhood-by-neighborhood basis, with all our educational tools and materials prepared in advance, and with regional organizers helping and coordinating, we go door-to-door and sign up neighbors to our organic neighborhoods associations. We interview everyone. Those already on board get a green flag on the map. Those not yet on board are educated, carefully and respectfully, to why they should join. At the end of the year, probably 80% or more of the land in the neighborhood is a, quote, poison-free zone. First of all, let me say, in every neighborhood, there will be at least one neighbor who will be inspired to double or triple his use of pesticides by this campaign. Just don't let that bother you. Nothing is going to deprive that person of their God-given right to poison themselves, their property, and their neighborhood. We don't stop there. Everyone is in a database, and we organize citywide. At the end of 3 to 5 years, we are so strong that we legislate locally what has become de facto an 80% of the private lawns and gardens, no chemicals. And, of course, I'm talking private lawns and gardens, but the schools, the parks, the apartment buildings, the meridians, that's all included here because a lot of people live in apartment buildings and have to be brought into this also. We don't stop there. That's just the beginning. We're doing this over 10 years in every neighborhood, in every town, every city, every state in the nation. Everyone goes into the database, and we are literally building self-educating, self-funding, politically powerful networks of millions of citizens. While over 10 years, we decreased pesticide, herbicide, and fungicide use by 25% nationwide. And in my research for this talk tonight, I came up with this figure. You can probably correct me, but the world market for pesticides 5 years ago was $37 billion. And one-third of that were U.S. lawn pesticides. One-third of the $37 billion pesticide market. So we're talking about kicking them in the gonads where it counts when we're reducing lawn pesticide use. So we don't stop there. This organized, educated group of citizens is also understanding that stopping the neighborhood poisoning makes no sense if we're eating non-organic food, if we're wearing non-organic clothes. We massively jumpstart the market for such products and tie the urban and suburban movement, the organic neighborhoods, into the rural organic food and fiber movement. Absolutely essential. We don't stop there. The groups organize together at the city, county, and congressional district and the state level and feel our power. We move on other conservation issues, water, power production. We unite with labor constituencies on fair trade issues. We target companies for massive boycotts that can actually win. We promote new democratic forms of business enterprise, such as cooperatives, worker self-managed businesses, and community endeavors that really can be responsible businesses, rather than just greenwash themselves with phony advertising claims like Starbucks. And at the end of 5 to 10 years, what we've done is we've turned this environmental movement on its head. We've reclaimed the legacy of Rachel Carson. We've reclaimed the legacy of Billy Shoecraft. We've taken our lead from the Carol Van Strums of the world, like most of you here, women. And what we do is we've turned the environmental movement on its head. We've turned it around from a top-heavy elite bunch of Washington, D.C., New York, New York, and San Francisco, California, overpaid, impotent, green bureaucrats partnering with industry who into the politically powerful grassroots-based network of effective organizations that the pesticide movement can jumpstart. And we're leaving groups like EDF and NRDC and others at the National Press Club, getting their awards from Ron Duchin, sucking up their contributions from BP Amoco. We're just leaving them. And we're saying to the foundations that are real environmental foundations, Why are you funding that garbage when Monsanto's funding that garbage? You know, if you're real about environmental change, this is the movement. We've built a new democratic environmental movement, and it starts right here, right now. And when the funding letters come from those big green groups, we just write on them, sorry, gang, call Ron Duchin. He can find you money. And mail them in. And we build in our communities, you know, and support ourselves because the money is there. And it's leaving our pockets and being sent to Washington groups that are selling out our interests with it. That's stupid. So, you know, some people at this point might say, well, that all sounds fine, Mr. Stauber, but can this really happen? If this doesn't happen, everyone might as well just go back to Plan A with me, move to northern Wisconsin. It isn't a matter of can. It's a matter of must. We have more power than we know. I mean, here we are meeting in Seattle, where 2.5 years ago, 100,000 people turned the world on its head and created, by the way, a whole new rush of business for the PR industry. You've never seen, you know, so many firms, even the most despicable and worst firms like Burson Marsteller pumping up their corporate social responsibility services. And, of course, how do you become a socially responsible corporation? You partner with big green groups and give them money. Anyway, without this movement, we can't do diddle. And as we can see from the past 30 years of spending, literally added up billions of dollars of individual and foundation money on national environmental groups that accomplish nothing, or even worse than nothing, we have to create this powerful movement that has always been the hope and the promise. And, okay, now, friends of mine like Carol Raffensperger at this point, sort of blanch and go, you know, I've got a lot of friends in the Natural Resources Defense Council, and I just don't like to hear you badmouthing these groups. And I go, I agree. I go, and, you know, I wish it were a worker self-managed organization, because I think if the people who work in these organizations actually set the policy, you know, you would see some real significant change, because I really believe that most of the folks who work in the big green groups in the trenches have come to understand what a farce it is to try to make change by begging bureaucrats in Washington and begging politicians sold out to corporate interests. And they understand that the power is at the grassroots, and they are with us, and they are with us. But these organizations are run by a small group of people, and they have virtually no democracy. You know, we talk about democratizing corporations. We need to democratize the environmental movement, for God's sake. We need to build this powerful democratic movement from the ground up. So, you know, what does it take to do this? Well, first of all, it takes a bunch of you nutty like me who really believe in this vision. It takes building on all the fantastic work that's been done with, like, pesticides in schools and realizing that that is for naught unless we literally reclaim our neighborhoods. And the wonderful thing about this is it's a two-tiered approach. First of all, we're doing it ourselves. We're not waiting for some harebrained bureaucrat who's going to go to work for Monsanto next year anyway to figure out that this is something he or she should do. We're not waiting for some sold-out politician to move on this. We're moving on it ourselves at the neighborhood level. And by the time we're done, and some neighborhoods are already far down this road, we will literally be able to ban pesticides at the local level. We'll be able to build this powerful political force, and we will be what we should be, which is one of the most powerful, aware, self-educated political movements for democracy and environmental justice that the world has ever seen. So these other organizations, they've had their day. They're the dinosaurs of the 20th century. I mean, the corporations have learned how to defeat them. They're obsolete. Yeah, they're filled with well-meaning people, but they're obsolete. And now our charge, especially if you're my age, is to try to mentor and create and foster this new movement. And a lot of us have been in the trenches for a long time, and we're worn down. But I think we can take our hope and inspiration and aspiration from the young people, like I have. You know, my good friend, my brother, Ronnie Cummins, for 30 years has been saying to me, you know, John, there's a new radical movement among the young, and it's going to change the world. And for 26 years, I've just gone, yeah, Ronnie. But it's true. It's out there. And what's going to happen with the folks who made Seattle happen? What's going to happen with the 100,000 people, you probably don't know this because it wasn't covered in the press, who were in Washington for peace last weekend, who get all this stuff, you know? 2 years ago, oh, gee, I'm using up my Q&A time. 2 years ago, when I went out to the International Monetary Fund meeting in April to see this new movement, it was amazing because I was press escort and I was taking around World Press and ABC and Washington Post and all these people in what was called the Convergence Center, where these young folks who practically shut down Washington for 3 days, 30,000 strong, were meeting and organizing. And people would say, well, we want to talk with a leader. And I go, well, it's a leaderless movement. Everything's by consensus. And they go, yeah, who's in charge? I go, well, I just told you. They go, well, who do I talk with? And I go, well, you can talk with anyone, but frankly, a lot of these young people don't trust the press, so you have to get their permission, and they don't want any sweeping camera shots. Okay, well, who should I talk with? I go, look, you know, there's 1,000 people here, just grab someone. And invariably, you know, finally, they'd be have to grab somebody, and they'd grab, you know, like a 19-year-old college sophomore from Carleton in Minnesota. And they'd say, why are you here? And eloquence. I mean, my generation, single issue, single issue. This generation weaves it all together. Corporate power, poverty, pesticide poisoning, ecological destruction, the economic institutions of the World Bank promoting unsustainability, corporate greenwashing. It's there. What we have to make sure is that, and I think my age might be average in here, that those of us who've been around the block do what we can to create this new movement, because these young people will work with us and they will lead it. So let's see, what do I want to talk about? I think I better just go to questions and answers, but let me say I am on the advisory board of the Organic Consumers Association. I'm pushing this really hard with that organization, and I think what we should all do is we need to keep this vision of creating the new environmental movement. And pesticides are the key. We need to reclaim the legacy of Rachel Carson, and we need to stop the poisoning in our neighborhoods where it's happening. Thank you.
That was fabulous.
Thank you.
We've been at it since 9 o'clock, and I have to say, I don't know if I speak for everyone, but I could listen to you for another half hour, an hour.
I'm glad you said
And he's got all the notes. I wanted to present you with an award on behalf of Beyond Pesticides. This is our most prestigious and our only honor. It's our leadership award, and it to read, it's for publicizing the truth about corporate polluters. And thank you so much for the great work that you do.
Thank you, Greg.
And the T-shirt, of course.
Okay. Thanks, John. Thank you. I'll try to be worthy of this.
Best place for the best concise sort of proof of these green environmental organizations, the big ones, and how they're funded or what they've been doing to corporate stuff, so we can give it to our neighbors or other people who say, well, wait a minute, no, I've been giving to, you know, or the list of the ones that are, you know.
Yeah, well, you can go to Mark Dowie's book, Losing Ground, which came out in 96 and is all about this. You can read our stuff. You can go to this website that reports on where groups get their money. One thing that we learned in writing Trust Us, We're Experts is that there's 600,000 nonprofit organizations in this country. Most of them were either started by business or accept business funding. And most of the big environmental groups now brag about, you know, the corporate funding they get. National Wildlife Federation, for instance, last year for a paltry $115,000, let BP Amoco for 6 months decorate its gas stations with National Wildlife Federation logos and promote itself as an environmentally responsible oil company. I mean, I don't want to be crude, but, well, I won't even say it. That's not much money for what you just did. This is no, you know, I would ask the organizations, what's your policy on institutional funders and who do you accept money from? This whole thing of partnering is huge. And if you go up on our website, you'll see a lot of documentation of it.
They can't change. You say they're non-democratic, the big green organizations, that they're kind of fixated on something that they can't really come to represent.
I think they're obsolete. One thing I've learned as an organizer is that, you know, the inception of an organization is really critical. And once an organization is set in a certain way and becomes very dysfunctional, it's really better just to sort of step back and start new organizations. And I think that's what we have to do. And if we create this exciting, effective, powerful grassroots environmental movement, that will transform the other organizations because they will be forced to take their lead from the grassroots leadership.
I don't know if you heard that question, but it was about the Sierra Club. And the question was, this woman works with her local Sierra Club organization in Michigan, and, you know, what have I got to say about local groups of national organizations? And the Sierra Club is really the one organization that does have local chapters and, you know, somewhat of a democratic system. Other organizations have people at the grassroots, but the Sierra Club chapters, I think, are very interesting. I know a lot of people in Sierra Club who work in Wisconsin, where I live. I know dissident Sierra Club people. When I was in New Mexico, I heard about a pro-nuclear Sierra Club chapter. But I worked on the animal confinement issue in Wisconsin, and I worked with Carol Terrell from Sierra Club, yeah, who's just great. I mean, she's been, you know, slogging in the trenches for years. And what I find really interesting about the Sierra Club, and I should be nice because they just reviewed Trust Us and gave it a wonderful review, but that in Wisconsin, where we're faced with this coming onslaught of factory farming, the local Sierra Club activists can't get any money from Sierra Club nationally to put into the fight. And Sierra Club, I think, really needs to completely change how it spends its money, and it needs to get money down to the grassroots. And I think the Sierra Club, I mean, look at David Brower's history with that organization, setting up Friends of the Earth and going back into Sierra, you know. The Sierra Club is an example of a national organization that has some democracy and good people in it. I mean, all these organizations have good people.
What's your take on the National Organic Standard Board and the USDA Organic Standard?
Well, I think organics is... I mean, it was amazing to me to watch how the Clinton-Gore administration tried to deliver organics into the hands of Monsanto, you know? They were two or three steps ahead of us because they realized that if they could force organic standards to apply, you know, for genetically engineered food to be organic, then there would be absolutely no choice for anyone in this country who wants to avoid genetically engineered food. In fact, they sparked a massive backlash, and it really empowered the movement. But I think that that's an ongoing struggle, and I guarantee you that the genetic engineering companies have all sorts of ways they're scheming on and pushing to try to reopen organics. I mean, I think organic, sustainable is absolutely key, but I also think that the key is we have to create these organic neighborhoods. Because what's really driving organics is the market. You know, I'm from a farm state like Wisconsin. And, yeah, the best thing about bovine growth hormone was it really spurred organic dairying in the state. But if we were organizing in the suburban and urban areas on the issues I described and linking up with our organic farmers, we would just tremendously magnify the possibility for organic sustainable agriculture.
I used to hear you all the time on Pacifica Radio, but I rarely hear you on NPR. Have you been slamming NPR and their ABM underwriters?
You know, I like listening to NPR, and I try to watch the Archer Daniels Midland News Hour. Sheldon and I have been interviewed for some programs like Marketplace, and Brooke Gladstone's on the media. And connections. But it's very interesting because usually I talk a lot about what our organization does. We work a lot with the media. The news media should be exposing the stuff we expose. They're not, because 40% of everything you see, hear, and read in the media is a result of the PR campaigns that we expose. They're dependent on it. And who runs the propaganda industry? 200,000 plus practitioners. Well, the biggest group of them came out of the news media, you know? So on and on. Our first book, Toxic Sludge is Good for You, is all about that. But I would say, yeah, NPR nationally, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting, just sliding downhill. We hear less from NPR, all things considered, the Archer Daniels Midland NewsHour than probably any other media. We hear more, we get more calls from Wall Street Journal reporters who either have information to share or are looking for information than from Corporation for Public Broadcasting. When you think of it, Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. Doesn't that sound like the worst of both worlds? Anyway, one more question.
League of Women Voters has a Dear Neighbor letter to give to your neighbors about alternatives to pesticides. Well, it's a Michigan interlead group, and then each local league can put their own logo along with ours. I'll send you one, and anybody else who wants to contact me. It's awfully grassroots. I mean, you roll this thing up and you show the logos and you put them in all the doors, you know, of your neighbors, and especially the people that are using the pesticides. My block is getting quite good. They're only about
three. All right. Well, Marjorie described the League of Women Voters
program taking pesticide information around. And let me just be really clear. We got to shut this stuff down. A third of all the pesticide use internationally in U.S. lawns. We got to, you know, really move beyond the symbolism and even the schools and just close it down. Shut it down.
I don't know good horse as we trot in this dark here, robbing the rich.
Now, in the 9 years since John Stauber made that speech, I think public awareness is growing quickly that we really do face some very serious problems in the immediate future, and of course many people are facing them right now, all of which is an encouragement not to stick within the legal confines of what is acceptable behaviour. And note of course that they are shrinking rapidly, particularly in the US, governments seeking to try and put dissent and protest on parallel with terrorism, because they are that scared that ordinary people will stand up for what is right. I think Steve Best's thought about, are you content to let yourself be constrained by the increasingly arbitrary dictates of what is deemed to be legal and what not, is worth bearing in mind. Given the mound of evidence of governments recently carrying out terrorist acts, starting wars which are, by any stretch of the imagination, blatantly illegal, and corporations not only routinely flouting, but changing or even writing the law to suit their own ends. And if you'd like to learn more about that evidence and are wondering where to start, 545 previous shows of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguest.net/archive. We are available on Twitter at twitter.com/unwelcomeguests, all one word. And there's a mailing list at altruist.org/unwelcome. Our theme song, The Unwelcome Guest, is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can. Just like the Bible.